all our societies were lawful historically, and when law broke down, then there was war, and then we had to rebuild our society. So our oral histories show the depth of time and the failure and promise of law. So it's something that has to be upheld and everybody has to work at. And we were non-state societies, so law was everybody's responsibility.
Hello, I'm Shauna Van Praagh, President of the Law Commission of Canada. Welcome to OBITR, an LCC podcast that features discussions with people across Canada who are living law, pursuing justice, and renewing hope in creative, challenging, colorful, and complex ways. The word obiter, or phrase obiter dicta, refers to words not understood to be crucial to what a case in law stands for. But it turns out that passages labeled obiter and thus overlooked sometimes become the most important or enduring. Inspired by the notion for which it is named, the Obiter podcast shines light on what might otherwise be missed or invisible in the evolution of law. In introducing listeners to a rich intersection of individuals, ideas, and issues, Obiter invites us into the many spaces in which law operates, evolves, and generates hope. Through conversations with guests who bring a wide range of experience and interests connected to law and justice, Obiter presents law reform as a collective endeavor that takes on many shapes, functions, and directions. The podcast promises to serve as a site for thoughtful reflection and active inquiry. The challenging of assumptions and the broadening of perspectives, the forging of connections and enriched understanding of the shared pursuit of justice across Canadian society. In this episode, we speak with a leading voice in the revitalization of Indigenous legal traditions in Canada.
We create resources for communities. They require kitchen table conversations, lots of community meetings. We're not trying to find one perspective. We want all the voices to be a part of it.
Dr. Val Napoleon, a member of the Soto First Nation and an adopted member of the Gitignau, is a trailblazer in the revitalization of Indigenous law in Canada. She started law school when she became a grandmother and has dedicated her career to advancing Indigenous legal traditions. Currently, the Law Foundation Chair of Indigenous Justice and Governance at the University of Victoria, she established the Indigenous Law Research Unit, a leading academic center working to build a future where Indigenous legal traditions, just like the world's other great legal traditions, are theorized, researched, and taught. Professor Napoleon has served as an acting dean of the University of Victoria's Law School, where she co-founded the school's unique dual law degree program in common law and Indigenous law. She also co-founded the National Center for Indigenous Law and is leading the next initiative of holistically rebuilding Indigenous legal orders. Val Napoleon continues to shape the future of Indigenous legal traditions and the teaching, learning, and practice of law. The Law Commission of Canada is proud to have nominated her as a recipient of a 2025 King Charles III Coronation Medal in recognition of her contributions to legal education and the revitalization of Indigenous laws and of her leadership in incorporating Indigenous teachings into the evolution of law throughout this land. Welcome to the podcast, Val.
What a wonderful welcome. I'm so honored by the nomination. And I love the intro, the obiter, to look at those things that are around what is officially recognized as law. We got a lot to learn from those things.
We do. So that actually is a nice invitation for my very first question, which makes reference to how I introduced you. I understand that you once said that law school is good for grandmothers and grandmothers are good for law school. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant and share with listeners a little of your personal narrative? I think that that statement and that sharing came from your own life trajectory and what it says about your approach to the teaching and learning of law.
When I applied to law school, there were There were various things. There's always more than one story for any particular situation. One was the act of becoming a grandmother, having that privilege, and wanting to be able to provide something meaningful to that little grandchild. And what I wanted to say is that if you want to do something, you have to go and do it. Nobody's going to do it for you. And then when I thought about that, I thought, well, I actually haven't done that. I applied to law school when I was in my early 20s, and I didn't go, even though I was accepted. And then the other context was that, or is that, it's sexist out there in Indigenous country. And I wanted to keep doing the kind of work that I was doing, which was community activism, working with justice, working with education, working to protect lands and forests and fish and water and all of those parts of the world. But what I saw was Indigenous women disappearing and taking up other roles rather than that which I wanted to do. So it was good for me as a challenge. Anything that I think causes us to learn and think in different ways through different lenses is a gift. And I think that as an older student, I was able to engage with the law school and with the teaching of law and from a different position, which I hope was helpful to my professors.
Might have been helpful to the students around you as well, I would think. So you talked about this a little bit as you were talking about kind of all of these factors that led you to through the doors, if you like, of a formal law school. But let me push you a little bit more to talk about that kind of 2.5 decades before going to law school, where you were mothering, becoming a grandmother towards the end of that 25 years or so, but working as a community activist, as a consultant in Northwestern British Columbia, working in the pursuit of justice, but intersecting with health and education, the fact that you worked on what became known as a judgment called Delgamuukw, a landmark case in land rights, Indigenous land rights in this country. So can you talk a little bit about how you continue to see the interweaving of that prior to law school experience with what you have done as a grandmother, as a jurist, and as a teacher of law? And then, of course, we'll talk more about specifically the projects that you've taken on.
Prior to law school, I had the privilege of working with Gik'san and Wet'suwet'en people in different capacities. And it was a holistic way of learning about Wet'suwet'en and Gik'san law from people who were practicing it. And what I worked with people to do was to find ways and create spaces for Indigenous law. The opportunity I had was to find ways so that the voices of Gik'san and Wet'suwet'en people could shape and form how we thought about today's governance, today's education, today's citizenry, and as ways to deal with contemporary issues and challenges. Wet'suwet'en and Gik'san law wasn't something that was in the past or something that was entirely philosophical or somehow removed from the everyday. What I was able to learn from the people around me who were, you know, hosting feasts to conduct business, who were passing on names, which are a form of governance, and who were ensuring that the polls were raised that represented their histories, all of the ways that people were acting on and demonstrating expressions of their law through those means, it meant that law was here now. It needed to be seen as law today. So that was the amazing, wonderful experience that I was able to learn from people in the Hazelton and Smithers area, that whole northern area. When I have talked with other students who've either at, you know, the undergrad level or graduate level or wherever, I realize how the gift of that experience positioned me to take up the work that I have I've been able to do in the law school as a teacher and as a writer and researcher. Without that experience, I wonder if I would have had the imagination that I was able to bring into law school for that. We needed a bigger imagination for what was possible for all law, including Canadian law. That was what I was able to bring as a result of the experience I had as a community activist.
Well, and it really underscores that importance of creativity and new ideas and taking imagination in directions that others might not have thought of, or they may have shared or gestured at, but you need to bring some confidence and a dream with you in order to bring that imagination to the table. And that's a nice segue into inviting you to talk about the Indigenous Law Research Unit, which you founded in 2012, known as a real leader in the revitalization and recognition of Indigenous laws in Canada. So for listeners who either know ILRU, that's the acronym for Indigenous Law Research Unit, know it, or who are listening and learning about this for the first time, can you talk a little bit about how important that imagination has been and how coming to the building of the unit with this idea of Indigenous forms of sharing and coming together and generosity and leadership, how that work has developed and evolved over the years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the research unit, you know, what I wanted to create, and, you know, I had marvelous people around me to help with the thinking, including Hadley Friedland, who was my graduate student at the time, and others. You know, what we wanted to do was to create a resource where Indigenous peoples could bring questions that they had about their own laws, about their own legal orders, and places where complex issues concerning Indigenous law and intersocietal kinds of questions, all of those things, where could people come to explore, into research, and to look into those questions? And we had the most amazing opportunity with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada and the Indigenous Bar Association. And we worked with them to set up a national program where we developed a methodology to look at 6 different legal orders across the country. And the question that we were researching was, how do people in this legal order legitimately respond to harms and injuries? And so we did that on the East Coast, in Ontario, Alberta, and then a number of sites in BC. So what we were doing was, instead of looking at Indigenous legal issues as something that had to be solved by Canadian law, we were looking at what are the resources from within Indigenous law, within Indigenous legal histories and precedent and legal principles and so on, that can be brought to bear on these questions. That methodology enabled us to expand and grow into the work. We used a narrative analysis method. We draw law from stories critically and systematically, and we synthesize the findings of all of that research into a report that communities own and can use, which sets out authoritative decision makers, legal responses, obligations, substantive and procedural rights, and guiding legal principles. So we create resources for communities. These take some years. They're not quick fixes. They're really hard work. They require kitchen table conversations, lots of community meetings. We're not trying to find one perspective. We want all the voices to be a part of it. The one that is the most recent one is with the Shikwemeq, and it's on citizenship, but it's Kwesiltan. So it's how people understand who comes to belong. And the 3 research questions posed to the oral histories and the narratives were, how do you become kin? The second question is, when you are kin, what are your obligations? And the third question is, when you fail your obligations and you cause harm, What are the remedies? And so those three questions were what enabled us to complete a report, as well as a casebook, as well as a community glossary. And these are available on our website with the permission of the Shekwepek. But that's an example of a report that now people can use for dealing with government or dealing with between internations or solving other problems having to do with citizenship.
I love the image of sitting around a kitchen table in complex conversation, right? Because and it just underscores those hard conversations, the fact that there aren't quick fixes, as you say, the fact that we're not looking for the answer, but instead sharing and accepting that there may be many ways to do things. How do we share space together? What does it mean to be close to each other? So, as you say, that notion of kin, and then what responsibilities are on our shoulders as we share that space? And we all know that sometimes we mess up and we make mistakes and someone can be hurt. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about some of the things that you heard or discovered and whether there were any surprises in terms of the possible remedies or ways to address needs in the wake of harm.
All our societies were lawful historically, and when law broke down, then there was war, and then we had to rebuild our society. So our oral histories show the depth of time and the failure and promise of law. So it's something that has to be upheld and everybody has to work at. And we were non-state societies, so law was everybody's responsibility. I've done other work with Denizah stories and narratives to look at what are the processes for living together across difference when people are different and coming together. And every group, Shekwepek, Denizah, Cree, everybody has intersocietal laws which offer ways of working together and ways of inquiry in order to create collaborative space for one another. So for the Denizah, you know, the concerns are always that the children are able to belong to both peoples, that there's a responsibility to figure out how to live together, and that can be to live together that allows difference. And then if there's danger, if one people caught are a danger to another, then there's a responsibility to take care of your family and your communities. But there's a process of inquiry to arrive at that point. So you have to investigate. You have to make sure that you have all the information in order to make the best kind of legal response. And then you have to have processes to ensure that they're fair and inclusive and all of that. So those are the resources that are available in different legal orders. So the Indigenous Law Research Unit, we work sector by sector. So governance, citizenship, forestry, or rather lands and resources, or water, or child protection. Like that's how we work with communities now. And so we take on different subject areas. And the communities own the materials, and then we share with their permission. So they can become teaching resources as well.
The Law Commission of Canada is an independent and nonpartisan agency committed to engaging the people of Canada in the ongoing and dynamic evolution of law. We offer responsible and responsive leadership and guidance on law, justice, and the renewal of hope. To learn more about us, visit the Law Commission of Canada website or follow us on LinkedIn and X. And to learn more about this episode of Obiter and others, check out our show notes.
Val, I kind of wish a podcast had a visual aspect to it. It doesn't. But so we have to ask our listeners to imagine the graphic novel on Cree criminal law, which your Indigenous Law Research Unit published about a dozen years ago now. And of course, a graphic novel is very different than most legal texts that people are used to, or if you haven't studied law, you know, you imagine the students of law working with. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that project in particular, a graphic novel, knowing that work is now part of teaching and learning in universities and colleges across this land. I can't help but share with listeners that the artist put you into the graphic novel, so we can find you in it as one of the characters. But an invitation to talk more broadly about that openness to kind of working with different forms and the significance of storytelling and that meshing together of innovative form and content.
Oh, man. So first of all, I want to say that the Headache Cho, who is the main character, one of the main characters in the graphic novel, is not me. What I told the artists to do was to create an old woman, but not make her like a stereotype grandmother. I wanted her to be kick-ass. I wanted her to be really out there, really strong and tough, and that's what they did. And so people think it's me.
Well, it looks a little like you, Val.
It's so funny.
But that's great.
So Nicomosis, we have a teaching guide that goes with it, and it's intended to come at numbers of issues, including mental illness, including gender, including abuse of power, and so on. And the toolkit provides lessons and resources that people can expand the text of Nicomosis further. And we have another graphic narrative coming out on couch and water laws. There are many ways to teach and learn law, and we need to find as many ways as possible so that we invite people in. Like, understanding the laws in our world is an important part of citizenship, all of our citizenships. And the work of rebuilding our legal orders is also the task of rebuilding citizenship, citizenries. And that's essential to civil society. It's essential to democracy. And so when you think about Indigenous law and the work that we're doing, it's important for Canada. It's important for us, but it's important for Canada. And we need to find many ways in order to take up and to continue that work so that we can understand our own lawfulness, understand our own legal agency, and understand how important that is in a civil society. This week, I went to my grandson's grade 2 class, and they did a legal analysis of a story. You ask them what the problem is, and what did people do, and what happened in the story, what was the decision that was made. And what I hope they continue to take from that is that we need to ask questions about everything, about stories. If we're going to learn, we need to ask those questions so that we can go on and expand how we think. So Nicomosis was our first project to begin doing that.
Your story of your grandson is a lovely reminder that we all start thinking about law and engaging in law from our youngest age, right?
Yes.
So we're capable of asking those kinds of questions. So now, though, I'm going to shift back to the innovation that you brought to the formal legal education offered at the University of Victoria. You co-founded this unique double law degree, which means that future jurists who graduate from University of Victoria's Law School can do so holding these two degrees, one in common law, one in Indigenous law. And so I wondered if you can talk a little bit about how unique that is, how challenging it is, but also how exciting that possibility of asking questions. As you just said, key to understanding and engaging in law is asking lots of questions. So how are those questions distinctive when explicitly you're invited to learn in more than one legal tradition at a time? And how important is it to make that space? And I know at University of Victoria, you're in the middle of kind of creating a physical space that will really be very exciting in terms of conveying those kinds of questions and curiosity and potential in thinking through Indigenous legal traditions. And as you say, in really showing all of Canada how significant they are in understanding where we've come from and in thinking about where we're going.
We have lots of amazing people here who, at the early conception of this, it was a unanimous support from our faculty. And we had John Burroughs, we had Sarah Morales, we have other amazing people who helped to build it all. So it remains unique in the world. There is no other dual law degree program. It's over 4 years. We launched it in 2018, and we have 25 students a year. So I teach common law property alongside Gixan land and property law. There's Darcy Lindbergh teaches Cree constitutional law alongside Canadian constitutional law. Sarah Morales teaches Halkomium or Cowichan torts alongside Canadian torts. So the subjects are dual in the first 2 years. And then in upper years, we have some intersocietal, or sometimes they're called transsystemic courses as well. So that idea is about how do we think about law and learn about law and work with law across legal orders. What's the process of doing that? And the first big challenge, of course, is for the professors, because we had to create all the material. And, you know, for the different subject areas, and with lots of learning, things that work and don't work in what we do. And it's not, you can't easily hold up the law, like, common law or Canadian law alongside Gixan or Tsilhqot'in or other law. They don't map onto each other. You have to find other ways to make the connections between the Indigenous and non-Indigenous subject matters. And so there's lots of challenges in that, but there's lots of amazing learning that happens within it as well. You know, so for instance, I'm teaching in Gixan land and property law, I'm teaching Indigenous intellectual property. So we're looking at how we organize our human relationships to the stuff of the world, whether it's tangible or intangible stuff of the world, from Indigenous legal perspectives, not from a Canadian or state perspective. What we find is that for Indigenous legal orders, the issue is control. Who gets to say and do what insofar as the stuff, tangible or intangible stuff in the world? Whereas what's happened with the establishment of centralized IP regimens is the shift has been to protection of cultural property as opposed to control of expressions of governance, expressions of economies, different ways of representing the legal order through tangible and intangible materials as well as processes. So, you know, students then are introduced to this whole other approach to how these things matter in a legal world. So that's, you know, one example. There's a public imperative to Indigenous law, just as there is in the legalities for state law. And what makes law law for the Gixan as well as for Canada? It has to be public. People have to know about it. There have to be public processes. You can look at how those work within Gixan society and how through history Gixan people have attempted to ensure that they act on their public imperative and that they extend their legality through those processes in a way that recognizes Canadian legality. And so that's one of the ways that people have been trying to work. So like starting from the early 1900s, if you look at the actions of what people were trying to do, the legal actions they were taking, you can understand what they were bringing, how they were bringing their laws to be lawful in their interactions with the settlers. So it's amazing learning opportunities.
It's really, I think, exciting to listen to you delve right in, talk about those challenges, and underscore in a very concrete way the connections between the teaching that happens of law, the learning of law, and the evolution of law's processes and substance, and our understanding of law's power and significance in our lives. I mean, I'm convinced, I think you know this, that knowledge of coexisting legal traditions in this country, in the world, enriches the understanding of people in general, not just of jurists, not just of people who hold, you know, law degrees, but that enriches the understanding of all of us of law's significance in our everyday lives. And so I wanted to invite you to talk a little bit about that, about how you articulate the link between what you are devoting, you know, your time and energy and career to, and how people who don't go and study law in a formal way, but of course live with law in their everyday lives, belong to different communities, do navigate these intersecting legal orders or traditions, even if they don't name them as such. So how do you articulate those connections?
It's so interesting. You know, when I first went to my own community and talked about, well, you know, Cree and Soto law, Indigenous law, they said, we don't have law. We have ways of organizing ourselves and managing ourselves, but we don't have law. And what I realized is that they were equating the sort of worst experiences they had with Canadian law with law and what it was. And they didn't want their own processes to be described as law because of that. So a lot of the work that we do with communities, when we start every project with a workshop, a 2 or 3 day workshop, and we go through questions about, you know, what makes law law that I asked earlier, but also what should it be? Like, how should it work? Whose voices should be heard or whose voices are not heard? And so all of those questions and discussions are a way to try and expand the understanding of law in our world, both informally and formally. Most people don't necessarily see all the ways that law is a part of their lives in terms of their mobility, like who they are insofar as work and their families and all of these things. All are touched by informal and formal law. And so law really matters. And so if we can move the conversations to what should our commitments to law be, what kinds of commitments will ensure that the law creates the kind of society that we want our families to live in, how we want to take care of one another. Like, what are those commitments or those legalities that we want to be centered in how we understand law? And it's particularly important for the rebuilding of Indigenous law. It's important for Canada. People need to be asking those critical questions for Canadian law. And for Indigenous peoples, like, I think that human dignity, gender equality, inclusive gender equality, human rights, legal agency, they have to be at the core of how we define what Indigenous law is, and not try and think of law as something else that's separated from those things that we can then add to later on. It has to be in the very conception of what constitutes law. And those are the conversations that we need to have everywhere, every possible place in terms of is where we need to talk about that. I think that we all need a coherent legal universe. We all need a way to create meaning. We all need to be able to engage with the relations of power that surround us as individuals and surround our families and surround our communities. That's what we need to build. We need to pay attention to what is going to build those relationships and healthy relationships, and how do we take care of one another. Like, that has to be, it has to be a legality.
And you've also reminded people that a coherent legal universe is one that embraces complexity. Coherent doesn't mean simple. It there's that depth that you just talked about. There's that multiplicity of intersecting commitments that we make within the universe. There's the call on all of us, to go back to the underscoring of the notion of kin or citizenship, this call on all of us to be part of this, to step up, to participate in naming the commitments and to living them, that it's not going to be done for us. And it's such an important reminder today, in particular. So that brings me to a broad kind of opportunity or question to wrap up. As you look to the future from your space, what you've done, what does the renewal of hope, or collaborating for hope, or nourishing hope look like for you?
One of the things I've started to do is to ask people to reimagine Canada, where all the Indigenous legal orders are functioning and they're healthy and they're operational and they're doing the work, enabling people to do the work of law. So what would Canada look like if we were able to see these legal orders and all the people that are a part of them managing themselves and taking care of conflicts and managing with each other and managing economies and the political life and so on? What kind of conversations would be possible then? So that's what I'm asking people to imagine. And so in thinking about our work, so we have the research unit, we have the Indigenous Law Degree Program. In a couple of months, the National Center for Indigenous Laws will be built. So the next project is to look at rebuilding Indigenous legal orders holistically. And we're starting with the first one in BC, and then I'm looking for partners across the country to figure out how to support that work nationally. Part of that imaginary is to try and create for Indigenous people a place of abundance and promise instead of scarcity, instead of a deficit where we're defined by the funding donors' priorities and so on. As generous as those donors are, sometimes they're not aligned with what will enable communities to really rebuild. We still have the highest incarceration rate for Indigenous peoples, and it's increasing. And we still have missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and that's increasing. These are things not just in Canada, they're global. And this is horrific that, you know, we have this. So my hope is that we're able to create this imaginary and then support one another to build it. And that our work to be lawful and to build or to maintain and build and create really strong communities and families is a way to withstand some of the craziness in the world, because Indigenous peoples are not immune or isolated from global political dynamics. They impact us not just physically with the demand for resources and all of those things, but insofar as ideologies and expectations and how we understand our place on this planet. I want for my grandsons to understand themselves as mattering to their universe and to this world, and that they be able to engage and to be productive in that world.
Well, thank you. I think that's a very inspiring and hope-filled vision. And the fact that you talk about rebuilding, I think, is also a reminder of something that I think has been a thread through what we've been talking about, which is it's hard work. It's hard work. And requires, I think, the energy that we associate with youth combined with the wisdom that we value in our grandmothers. And I think that it's so appropriate that you model that combination, I think, of youthful energy and insightful wisdom that we will all need to rally and bring to the work of rebuilding. It's really an honor and a delight to learn from you, to share you with the listeners of this podcast, to make this connection between the work that you're doing and the Law Commission of Canada. So thank you so much, Val.
Thank you for your questions. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Val Napoleon joined us from Victoria, British Columbia. That's it for this episode of Obiter, a project of the Law Commission of Canada. The Obiter team consists of producer Brian Peebles and editorial assistant David Dastou. Frédéric Sauvé is our associate producer and Farah Akhtar, our project manager. Wayne Gisbrecht is our studio technician. Our sound designer and director is Dominique Girard. Obiter is produced by Cascade Communications. I'm your host, Shauna Van Praagh. Thanks for listening.